Oh, you're absolutely right. My father came down, called me a slut and a tart, and dialed the social services. I'm laughing, but it's bitter.
She found the medical records at DeWitt Army Hospital in Fort Belvoir, and there was only one boy born the day I was born, and he did not have a first name. Actually, the girl that found that information said you should look on adoption support forums. Within hours, I stumbled across Carol Brobeck. Here's a Brobeck who gave a child up for adoption in 1980. I was born baby boy Brobeck in 1980. Pretty sure this is her.
I think they had an awfully hard time looking me in the eyes for the next 3 months. If they did, what would they see? They would see the unmaking of me, and they couldn't watch that because they actually thought the pregnancy was the unmaking of me. The unmaking of everybody, I suppose.
I think I found a grant that she had written while she worked at the Folger Shakespeare Library. Actually, I placed a call and asked for Carol Brobeck. They transferred me right away and I hung up. I made it so it was possible to have the very next day off.
I hoped he was healthy. I mean, that was just so important to me. I hope he's tall, not short and fat like the rest of us. I just wanted him to have the privilege of being totally who he was, whatever he had become. It was June 14th, Flag Day. Celebrated every year now.
Not knowing anything about the Folger Shakespeare Library and being a naive 18-year-old, and sort of thinking, well, if I'm going to go introduce myself to somebody who may or may not be ready to see me, whether they like it or not, I'm going to introduce myself.
And I had gotten to work late that day and in a surly mood, and it was hot and humid, and I was bothered. And there was an all-staff meeting at the library in which everybody leaves their offices and goes to the theater.
So I shaved, which I'm not want to do. And I believe I even ironed a shirt and put on, my sort of cheap suit that I had at that point.
So when the meeting was over, 10:45 or so, the entire library then floods back out from the theater and through the hall and then back around the guard's desk.
Walked into the visitor entrance up to the front desk and politely asked for one Carol Brobeck.
And as I was going around the guard's desk, Nathan said to me, "Carol, there's someone here to see you." And I was still in a pretty bad mood, but I went through this checklist in my mind, and it was, I don't have any people meetings scheduled with somebody interested in applying for a fellowship. I'm not interviewing any interns. I don't know what this is.
The lady at the desk kind of kept looking at me funny. And I thought, first, it must be because of this ridiculous suit that I'm wearing. But the more she looked at me, the more I thought, oh no, she knows exactly who I am, which means that Carol's going to know exactly who I am. And then at that moment, as I was processing that,
And
ding!
I turned around, and there was this beautiful young man in a suit and a tie and an earring. And I looked at him, and I did my checklist again. And then I also did this, oh, don't go there, don't go there, don't go there, don't go there.
And it was obvious she knew right away exactly.
But I was telling myself not to go there. And I don't know why, except that that is one of the fantasies that I've had for years. I kind of walked over towards him and I extended my hand. And I also had my cigarettes with me. And I was kind of moving him out the door because the staff was still coming through. And so somehow or another, we maneuvered out the door. So we were out front of the library.
We went outside. Thank God she was a cigarette smoker, because I was too, and I needed one.
And he said, you didn't get my email, did you? And I said, no, I'm sorry. I got into work late. I haven't even turned my computer on.
And I didn't get to tell her who I was. She just sat down quietly. I sat down next to her.
And then he said, you don't know me, do you? And I said, well, the thing is, I think I do, but should I know you as I think I know you? And he said, uh-huh. And I guess we'd move down some more steps. And I said, is your birthday December 26, 1980?
Were you born December 26, 1980? And I said, yep.
And I'm it was amazing I didn't pass out and kill myself on the marble steps. But at that point, I was shaking and staring at him and shaking and feeling weak in the knees and stupefied, happily stupefied. And I looked at him and I said, "You're alive. You're alive. You're alive." And he pulled me into a hug and he said, "Yeah, I thought you needed to know that." It's just, you've no idea what it's like to be voluntarily hugged by the child you gave away. I don't know what words there were there. I just remember this kind of visceral jubilation.
Pardon my French, but I think it was a whole moment.
And I said, "Well, if you don't have to go back to work, Lord knows I'm not working today." You know, I was just like bouncy.
And then she said, "You stay right here." And she went in and told her boss, "Something's kind of come up here. I'm going to take a little time this afternoon."
Where do we go? What do we do? Can I feed you? Can I buy you brunch or lunch or whatever? Can I feed you? That's all I could think I wanted to do was let me feed my son.
And we went to some diner.
So we went down to Jimmy T's on 5th and East Capitol.
Sat down and talked, and she just asked question after question.
He could eat a bit, but he was kind of shaky. I couldn't eat at all. It was like bite of toast, swig of coffee, bite of toast, swig of coffee, just staring at
me. Where have you grown up, you know?
And he told me that day that I had this 2-year-old granddaughter.
I think that excited her. I guess the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, though, right? I was 18 with a kid. Here I was asking the lady who had a kid at 20.
And so I ended up walking him down to where he'd parked down by the Washington Monument. And
she had definitely been curious. And now as I look back, I would have been the same way. Very curious.
He got his car and then he drove me back to the Folger. And then I had to watch him drive away.
I had gotten what I needed. And she had only scratched the surface on what she needed. But I didn't know I had really any needs until she developed those curiosities instantly in me. And that was the end of the day.
I don't know if I'll ever see him again, but I know his name. I'll never lose him again. I think we might have had our maximum. I mean, that there was like, this can go on forever, but it can't get better right now. Well, it can only go on forever.
This Can Go On Forever, produced by Shay Shackelford and Virginia Millington for a live audience at the DC Listening Lounge, this year's Third Coast Bronze Award winner. Now, some of the power of this piece derives from its restraint. The story itself could have gone on forever, but instead, producers Shay Shackelford and Virginia Millington decided to end the story right after Carol and Joel reunite.
I don't know how many times Shay and I sent around the ending. Any attempt we tried to make to add closure to the story didn't make sense.
Putting any kind of bow on it really just never fit. We wanted to leave it with some sort of forward momentum. Joel and Carol went into this from different places and came out of this in different places. There was a lot of bittersweet because you want him to want to be more with his mother. But something about this fits, and it's fine. It's not resolved, but it's real. I think that's part of why this ending fit, is that was as close as we could get to conveying that emotion to a listener.
What is their relationship like now?
Well, I would say they're still part of each other's lives to a certain extent. I mean, Joel has children of his own, 2 children now at the time of the story. He had one. It's, you know, something that evolves day by day.
They seem to have they have good respect for each other, and they seem to have a good communication. But Carol wishes she had more Joel in her life and more of Joel's family. And I wrestled with that for a long time until I was playing the piece for someone. We were getting close to finishing it and sharing this thought. And they said, "Isn't that the relationship between every mother and their son?" At which point I realized I owed my mother many phone calls.
To see a Polaroid of Carol's son Joel when he was a baby, check out thirdcoastfestival.org. I'm Gwen Macsai, and you're listening to Best of the Best, the 2010 Third Coast Festival broadcast. The Third Coast International Audio Festival is an independent, nonprofit arts organization made possible with lead support from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Questions? Comments? Write to info@thirdcoastfestival.org. Coming up after the break, Lonely Goalkeepers and Lonely Funerals. Stay tuned. Best of the Best is produced by the Third Coast Festival and distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.
I'm Tom Rogers.
I'm Sean Powers.
And I'm Celeste Quinn. You listen to us on WILL Radio and TV, and now we want to listen to you. Every month, we're out in the community having conversations about your hopes and challenges. What we hear impacts the programs we produce. If you'd like to have a community conversation in your town, give us a call at 217-333-7300 or email willconnect@illinois.edu.
You're listening to Best of the Best, the 2010 Third Coast Festival broadcast. I'm Gwen Macsai. Loneliness is rarely funny or quirky. Mostly, we associate loneliness with melancholy and gloom. And yet, next up, we have two award-winning stories that show that within loneliness, you can find not only humor, but respect and grace. First, we travel to the playing field, where team sports are usually hailed as the antidote to isolation, full of camaraderie, confidence boosting, and the whole all-for-one thing. In reality, not so much. Case in point, the 2010 Third Coast Director's Choice Award winner, The Loneliness of the Goalkeeper.
Best going into the box, ahead of first time, and another great save.
With a seamless combination of interviews, archival tape, music, and an actual soccer game, producer Adam Fowler makes you realize that whether you're a soccer fan or not, what's going on between the goalposts is something we can all identify with. Here's an excerpt that begins with a conversation between Bob Wilson, a famous goalkeeper in the UK, and the BBC program host Hardeep Singh Kohli, a former goalkeeper himself, if on a more amateur level.
Now here's a challenge that I've never understood. If you're a goalkeeper in a team that isn't very good, you're constantly vigilant. The ball's always coming at you. If, however, you're Bob Wilson playing behind 10 of the best players in the world at that time, for 89 minutes of a 90-minute game, you don't have a great deal to do. How do you stay focused?
Did you remember the Bionic Man? Mm. When the ball was at the other end of the field, I imagined that the guy on the ball, the opponent, was Steve Austin. So he could turn around at any part of the pitch, 60 yards away, 70 yards away, 110 yards away, and strike a ball towards my goal.
Rapide is still on the attack. There's the cross in. Wagner with a header. Fantastic save by Schmeichel. Absolutely.
By the byline, left-footed cross. Here's the chance. Oh, must score and doesn't. Brilliant save by Basso. Tips it on.
Left-foot shot driven long. Schmeichel saves again.
Great save. What a crucial man he is.
Right across the area. Chance of a Brazil. And it's no, it's not there. What a magnificent save by Gordon Banks. A superb piece of running by Jardino. Went down the right. Crossed the ball. And there was Pelé coming in.
Charlie, go out wide.
Watch it back, that's it.
That's it, challenge. Go, Ned. That's it, off you go. Go on.
Here we are. Sunday mid-morning. South coast of England, Brighton, and in the background you can hear some under-16s, 22 of them, chasing a ball around a pitch. Well, actually, technically speaking, it's 20 of them, and there's two goalkeepers either side, on their own, with no one to talk to. the game to watch, the backs of their colleagues and the face of their opposition. Almost poetic. It's me getting carried away with myself. Mom will cross the road. I'm here to meet a man called Jim Wall, who is an actor. That was a good wee tackle there. Sorry, slightly put off by a great wee tackle. Now, Jim is acting in a Peter Flannery play called The Boy's Own Story, which is all about a goalkeeper.
Yeah.
All right. So we've just kicked off then?
We've just kicked off, but we're about 10 minutes in and the Preston Panthers are a goal down, I'm afraid.
Was that a goalkeeping error?
It was not goalkeeping error. I'm a fully paid-up member of the Goalkeepers Union, so I think even if it had gone through his hands, I wouldn't have said it was the keeper's fault. No, it was a very good long-range shot and a very good midfield pass, so...
See, now, I don't mean to be cruel, right, but see that goalkeeper there?
Yeah.
Is that our keeper or their keeper?
No, that's their keeper. Okay. Our keeper's the quality-looking keeper with the yellow top and the gloves.
See their keeper? That's exactly what I looked like when I was a boy. I don't mean to be cruel.
How would you describe him, then?
Well, slightly lardy. Slightly lardy.
I don't play in goal, but I coach the goalkeepers down here. But I have to say, when I was a kid, the idea of going in goal... just baffled me. I thought, why would you want to go in goal? I've always been fascinated by the kids who want to go in goal. But later on in my life, when I became an actor, I ended up doing a play about a goalkeeper. So I got to meet goalkeepers. I even did 2 days training down here with Brighton and Hove Albion as a goalkeeper, and just became increasingly fascinated. They are the drummers of the football world, is how I've seen it. They are loners.
Rock on. Because I was a drummer and a goalkeeper.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
Well, so there is a link.
There is a definite link.
Yeah. No. Ooh.
Is that a goal?
Yeah, that's 2-0.
Sorry, that's 2-0 to the other team. Look at the keeper. He's looking skyward.
And he won't pick the ball up.
He won't pick the ball up. It's gone actually through the net.
I mean, nobody... That should have been cleared.
The cross should never have come in.
No.
But the goalkeeper got the blame for that.
Yeah. But these goals are actually... These aren't full-size goals.
But you even know what, so, Jim, you just take a look. Exactly.
So it's particularly unfair. I think goalkeepers get a rough deal. I mean, when we were doing the play, it was a very simple set. It was simply goalpost and net. Okay, so full size, and set in the penalty area of John McKenna, the greatest goalkeeper never to play for England. So he's asking for the ball, talking, you know, as goalkeepers are supposed to do, to keep themselves mentally alert. And the thing is, he never gets the ball. They hate him. The team hate him, and they will never pass to him. Good tackle, Dave. Lay off, Dave. Come on, Dave, if you need me. Oh. All right, don't then. Well played, Dave. See what I mean? They'd rather do without me. I'm the last line of defence. When I'm called into the game, it means they've failed, and they don't like that. Do you, lads? Of course, they're glad to have me here just in case. Glad it's me throwing myself about. Glad it's my head that goes in when the boots are flying. But they'd do without me if they could. Wouldn't ya? The object of their game is to score goals. The object of mine is to stop them. I'm here to spoil their game. I can't win a game. I can only lose it. So how can I be one of them? Not that I want to be one of them. When to them, I'm just a necessary evil. Go on, kid, have a shot. Let one go. No, don't tackle it. I could have saved that.
Side forward. Greg saved the ball, tipped it up in the air, but not enough to put it over the bar. It came down behind him, and as he went for it, so he was charged by centre forward Lofthouse into the net, ball as well.
Greg has been taken.
You put your head in there to be kicked. You know, I mean, I have multiple scars on my skull. I had a left ear torn off at Ipswich Town. I broke ribs. I had a punctured lung. I broke my arm. I broke my wrist. I dislocated an elbow for the sake of winning a game of football.
Because that's sort of your trademark, Bob, wasn't it? You had no fear. Somebody described you, obviously, as an Arsenal fan and a Scotland fan, I think unfairly. Eric Todd in The Guardian said, to play the way Wilson plays, you need courage, speed of thought, determination and an IQ of 20.
But it was right. I mean, my first idol was Bert Trautmann, who I idolised him because I could do what he did, dive headlong at people's feet.
He's racing right on, and Trautmann has to take the ball away from his toes.
It led him into catastrophe nearly when he broke his neck in the 1956 Cup final.
And I think Trotman's hurt. Yes, and so's Murphy. Looks like Murphy's knee and Trotman's head.
Do you remember that?
I remember it as if it was yesterday. And he played for 20 minutes effectively with a broken neck. It just built up this aura that I had about Bert.
Now, Trotman really does look hurt, and it's no fun.
Bill Shankly did identify brilliantly something that separates goalkeepers, what he described as a desperate sort of courage. And he said all great goalies need a desperate sort of courage within their makeup.
A goalie named John Thompson.
Talking about a desperate sort of courage, you will remember John Thompson.
That is desperation beyond. It was Celtic Rangers game.
So he was and a John Celtic Thompson, keeper, John Thompson.
He stopped an absolute certain goal, but he lay down and he was unconscious and he never regained consciousness and he died. The game was at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and he died at 9 o'clock that night.
Goodbye, Johnny Thompson. Sure, the best of friends must part, but no more you'll defend the Celtic on the slopes of Celtic Park.
I was a young goalkeeper. I played for St John's Primary School in Sevenoaks.
Poet and keeper, Murray Lachlan Young. Keeper in the loosest sense of the word.
We played a local big team, the sort of Manchester United of the area, which was Amherst School, and I think they beat us 17-0.
The scoring of which goal broke the young Murray Lachlan Young?
I think it was probably about 5 or 6-0 when I realised that there was probably only about 10 minutes of the game gone. The team had gone from being encouraging to looking the other way.
How long did it take you before you went back in goal?
I think about 32 years.
It may just be a coincidence that you are a poet and a writer and a performer. I too, writer, to some degree a performer, broadcaster, ended up in goal. Do you think there is a commonality in that experience of the creative?
For people who think they're a bit special, Perhaps it seems to be the ideal place, because as a striker, you can always be partnered with another striker, but there is only one goalkeeper and he gets to wear a different strip than the rest of the team and has his own universe to operate in.
The strange thing about being a goalkeeper is you're not part of the outfield team. You're a loner, yet you want to be relied upon.
I know what you mean. I do. I think that makes a lot of sense. Wanting to belong, but not wanting to belong.
Because my idea was to get you to write a poem about goalkeeping, and you've gone a step beyond expectation. What have you done?
The idea for a ballad came straight to me. Being an Arsenal fan lifelong, I still feel the pain of Paris and Naeem and for David Seaman.
It was 95, the UEFA Cup Winners' Cup against Real Zaragoza.
Yes, Cup Winners' Cup final.
Well, Seaman was crucial to Arsenal's success in Auxerre, playing there despite two broken ribs. He was crucial in Genoa. Those three critical penalty saves in the shootout. It's going to be down to David Seaman again, unless someone can score the final minute of extra time. Merson plays it forward.
Seaman had been amazing all the way through the campaign, and it was headed for penalties. And if there was a guy who was going to beat the other team at penalties, then it was David Seaman. So we were all waiting for the last whistle so David could come on and shake his thing again.
We were waiting for Seaman to be the hero. Little did we expect.
Which made it even crueler. It's called The Lobbing of David Seaman.
You're going to sing it?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Ah, come all ye teenage goalkeepers and listen unto me. I'll tell you of a goalie who went out to gay Paris. The Gunners call him safe hand.
The Loneliness of the Goalkeeper, winner of this year's Third Coast Director's Choice Award, was produced for BBC Radio 4 by independent producer Adam Fowler of Ladbroke Productions.
I'm not a soccer fan. You know, I know nothing about football. I can't play the game.
I have a 3-year-old son who's constantly wanting me to play football with him. He thinks I'm great at it, and it won't be too long before he realises otherwise. And maybe that helped. Maybe if I had been a soccer fan, I would have focused too much on the sport.
So when your presenter came to you and said, I think it would be a great idea if we did a show about goalkeepers, was your first reaction, huh? Or was it like, yes, I've always thought that?
Well, you want me to answer that as a working freelance?
I like to think, and I hope I'm not being immodest, that I can really find integrity and narrative in any subject and any block of material. I hope that doesn't sound too pretentious. So the fact that it's about goalkeepers, I've made programmes about all sorts of things. I've made programmes about maps. I've made programmes about bagpipe bands, you know, wars, whatever. But it's always finding that spine through it, that narrative, that human hook through it. So the sporting element wasn't the main one that we were going for. It was this human condition, this loneliness that we were going for.
Producer, Adam Fowler. Death and the ritual surrounding it can bring out the most visceral feelings of loneliness. But the city of Amsterdam believes that no one should be buried in solitude, even if no family members or friends are there to claim a body. Producer Michelle Ernsting won a Best Documentary Honorable Mention Award with her extraordinary portrait of the unlikely combination of two people, a poet and a civil servant, who came together to transform the lonely funeral into a lasting goodbye. The poet, who goes by Starik, had heard about the lonely funerals and thought that poetry would add a lot to the services. Herr Fritz, the civil servant, was less sure. This excerpt begins with him.
Suddenly my email box was filled with a request from Mr. Starik. He had a great plan, poet on the funeral. He kept on sending emails.
What did you think? Did you think when you got these emails, this is a crazy idea?
No, not a crazy idea, but I thought privacy. Yeah, it's privacy. They wanted to know things about my dead persons. And
so you really felt responsible for all of these people that had been found dead?
Yeah. On a certain day, I invited him in my office, and there we had a nice chat.
Hij bood aanblik van als een beroepsmilitair.
Starik remembers it a little differently. He says he went to the social services office and met a man with a direct gaze and a military bearing.
Had hij van dat kort geknipte borstelige haar, een snor, een sterk gegroefd gelaat.
Ger Fritz had a brush cut and a trim mustache. He wore his mobile phone in a holster. He was decisive and distant. Fritz underscored the fact that the funerals must be perfectly organized, all I's dotted, T's crossed.
Hij was zeer beslist over dat een uitvaart tot in de puntjes perfect moet verlopen en dat hij daar geen enkele.
He would not permit any breach of protocol. Chapel, flowers, three pieces of music, four pallbearers, and above all, respect for the deceased.
When he left my office, he had a bad feeling about it, and he was very amazed that a few hours later, or maybe the next morning, I don't remember, that I phoned him and said, you want to do a poem? Okay, let's try.
Starik.
Starik says the call was brief. Okay. Herr Fritz told him there was a death and gave a few details.
Goed. Wanneer?
But Starik had the feeling he was holding back. He kept asking Fritz for more information. There wasn't much. It was an anonymous death. No one could establish the identity of the man.
Yeah. Wie?
But it was Starik's first poem, so he persevered. Where was the person found? How old were they? Fritz gave him minimal information.
Nee. Okay, bedankt. Dag.
I knew a lot about the people who were dead. I often had information which I kept for myself.
And what was the information that you would hold back?
Well, poets are emotions, it's feelings. And I worked with facts. An example, men died, had 10 children. No child came to the funeral, not interested. That is a fact. But a poet could make very much emotions to that. And I didn't want it on a funeral. And then someone died from alcohol. It's a fact. But I don't think it was for the poet to know that.
So it was the information that you thought might make the person look bad somehow?
Yeah.
So correct. You really wanted to protect that person?
Correct. That's correct.
And why? Why so much privacy after someone has passed on?
I couldn't judge about why the children weren't interested in their parent. I couldn't judge about the alcoholic problems from other people. It's not for me to judge about it.
So you worried that the poets were going to bring in that sense of judgment. And did they?
No, they never did.
Ik vond het niet zozeer frustrerend als wel...
Sadek says the withholding of information didn't frustrate him. In fact, he was impressed by Gerfrit's careful approach. He found the whole situation inspiring.
De situatie was een inspirerende situatie voor mij. Dus het was...
The first poem was born with ease.
Het gedicht werd vrij gemakkelijk geboren, zeg maar. Dag, man zonder naam. Ik groet u. Onderweg naar het laatste land waar ieder welkom wordt geheten. Waar niets van niemand hoeft te weten. Dag, meneer. Goodbye, stranger. I say goodbye. On the road to nowhere, to the final country where everyone is welcomed in. Where nothing needn't know your origin. Dag, meneer. Zonder papier, zonder identiteit. Farewell, sir, without papers, without identity. What were you looking for? How much did you lose along the way? Wie staart nu door een leeg raam en wacht u? Who stares through the empty window, waits, nameless man, wait while I speak and entrust my empty words to this empty room. I am too late. You, I never knew. Niet in uw zwakheid, niet in uw kracht. Not at your weakest, not in your strength. Not in the final country where you are greeted without name. I don't know the words you spoke, not me. Wie dan heeft u lief gehad? Who then loved you? In which rooms did you sleep? Who kissed you goodnight? Who will wear out your shirt? Who will want to stand where you once stood? Who now takes the road you took? Who still looks for you? Who remembers whence you came? Wie weet nog waar u vandaan kwam? Who heard the voice calling out for you to come on home, man, to your final haven, Amsterdam? Die u toen riep naar uw laatste haven, Amsterdam.
It was great. It was great. It was so good for me. For me, it will. And it started with dag, man zonder naam. Goodbye, man without name. And he wondered in that poem, who combed his hair, who polished his shoes, who was your mother. It was great, great. It validated the funeral and the men from the cemetery, and they all said, that's good, that is nice, and so we continued it.
And they've kept it up, year in, year out. Lonely funerals, as they become known, with a poet and a civil servant sitting on either side of the aisle in the front pew. Stadek says that the poem is first and foremost for the deceased.
Ik ben geen religieus aangelegd mens, maar...
He's not a religious man, neither is Ger Frits, but he feels that the funeral is a moment of reckoning. It's your time at Heaven's Gate.
Je komt voor de hemelpoort te staan. Je moet
Someone needs to put in a good word for you. Everyone should have that right.
Dat ieder mens daar zeg maar recht op heeft.
He says one of our essential qualities is our need for a story.
De mens is een verhalenmachine. Dat maakt zijn identiteit uit. En
people are story machines. We're always busy making and remaking our stories.
What The Lonely Funeral does is return stories to people who have somehow lost theirs along the way.
That was an excerpt from The Lonely Funeral, produced by Michelle Ernsting for Global Perspectives, a series by Radio Netherlands Worldwide. The story won a 2010 Third Coast Honorable Mention Award. I'm Gwen Macsai, and you're listening to Best of the Best, the 2010 Third Coast Festival broadcast. The Third Coast International Audio Festival is an independent, nonprofit arts organization. We would love to hear your thoughts about today's program. Write to us at info@thirdcoastfestival.org. Coming up after the break, the Third Coast Radio Impact Award winner. Stay tuned. Best of the Best is produced by the Third Coast Festival and distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.
The vote in Ivory Coast went smoothly and people were optimistic.
A very good thing, because now we'll be able to undertake the development of the country, really.
But when the results came in, the current president dug in, and now Ivory Coast is again slipping towards civil war. U of I English instructor Carol Spindell watched the vote. Hear her personal account of the election and the aftermath. Ivory Coast, One Village Votes. Friday morning at 10 on WILL AM 580.
Welcome back to Best of the Best, the 2010 Third Coast Festival broadcast. I'm Gwen Macsai. Each year, the Third Coast Festival recognizes one story that brings out tangible change with its Radio Impact Award. This year, the honor went to the story of a young man born in Mexico who was brought to the United States as a child, grew up as an American, and then one day found out he wasn't. That's when he realized that his entire future hinged on something he had absolutely no control over. The 2010 Radio Impact Award goes to American dreamer Sam's story. And the crazy thing is, this radio story almost didn't happen. Producers Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister were in Elkhart, Indiana, doing a story about high school graduates entering tough economic times when things took an unexpected turn.
We did a series of interviews with graduating seniors, and they weren't very good, frankly. So we were getting a little frustrated. And
a little?
Elizabeth was actually ready to bail on the whole story. We ended up going to the counselor we were working with and saying, well, do you just have one kid who can tell a good story, who's really, you know, a good talker and has some sort of sense of himself? And she said, well, I do have this kid named Sam. And she didn't really tell us anything about him. So we sat down with Sam, and he revealed that he was a sax player. He revealed that he was a little confused about his legal status, but that he might be undocumented. He began to sort of describe his life in really interesting metaphorical ways. I'm graduating. It's like I'm going to jump, and I don't know whether there's rocks or feathers at the bottom. Elizabeth and I didn't even really need to look at each other. After about 15 minutes, we realized at the same time this was not the story of graduating seniors in Elkhart and going off into the world. This was Sam's story.
Prior to Sam, we had talked to 8 kids. I really was ready to just call it quits. And then this magic thing happens where this really, really beautiful person walks in and just has everything to say. And, you know, you just sit there completely captivated.
Bertha is my saxophone. I've had Bertha 3.5 years, and she's old and seen some action, but she's amazing, pretty much. Girlfriend takes first place, though.
My name is Sam. I'm 18. I'm a senior here at Central, and I'm in the band and stuff, and jazz band, and I was drum major this year, and past 4 years have been great, and I'm finally, you know, ready to graduate and get out of here.
Thanks for coming to the senior concert tonight. You're in for a treat.
Tonight is our senior concert, and this is kind of like the last football games and where the seniors are, you know, awarded.
Sam has been great for about 3 years, but he's really stepped it up to the next level. And this year's Woody Herman Outstanding Jazz Award goes to Sam.
My name's Tim Kernel. I'm the band director at Elkhart Central High School.
This is Sam, featured in a sentimental mood.
Sam is one of the probably top five musicians I've had. You know, 150 years, I've taught for 18 years.
At first, I feel nervous, but then I'm like, dude, just let go.
He tries to, in his solo, build his solo. This is what is so advanced about him. He starts somewhere, goes somewhere, and finishes it. He tells a story.
I'm actually from Mexico, and I got here when I was 5.
My name is Sam, and I'm Sam's father. We come with visa. Of course, it's expired, but we still have it.
I don't remember much, and I haven't really asked him. It just hasn't really been brought up.
Samuel, he don't know anything about it. He just came with us. We never asked him to come. He never say no, he never say yes.
I've been raised an American. You know, that's all I know. Heck, I'm playing jazz. How more American can you get?
Okay, so our first senior we want to recognize tonight, he's going to St. Joe College in Rensselaer, Indiana, with $1 million scholarship, it seems like. Kelsey Danny.
Most of my friends, oh, where are you guys going? Oh, I'm Butler bound, or I'm going to IU, Ball State, New Orleans, Hawaii.
And going to Purdue is our saxophone slash tubist, Keith Hoover.
Where are you going, Sam? I haven't decided yet. Yeah, that's my crappy answer.
It was the most, in my 18 years of teaching, confusing thing, is Sam not being accepted to one of those colleges because of how well he plays. It didn't occur to me that Sam was undocumented at all, and frankly, I didn't care. My job is when the kid comes in, get him a horn, teach him how to play it.
I first found out about his legal status when I actually confronted him about it.
Michelle's my girlfriend, and she's American. She's from the South, and she's a really, really good piano player.
What drew me to Sam in the first place? Duh, he's really attractive. So that was like the first thing I saw him with sax. I'm like, oh, wow.
And I was like, wow, she's pretty cute. The guy thing, you know.
I just picked up on a few things, you know, the way his family acted and how his parents were really cautious about a few things and how Sam avoided certain conversations. And one time I asked him, dude, why don't you have your license yet? And he's kind of like, well, and he gave me this answer that I didn't quite get because I'm sitting going, that makes no sense. But I didn't say anything. I was just like, you know, whatever, keep it cool. One day I just asked him, I'm like, so your family's pretty much illegal, aren't they? And he's kind of like, And he didn't know what he could tell me because his parents have always told him, you know, don't tell anybody, which is understandable.
My mom's always been like, don't give a lot of information, you know, to a lot of people because it could go wrong. If we did have to go back to Mexico, to be honest with you, I would not know what to do because I don't know the language, I don't know how to write. Barely speak it.
He had no clue how the life over there is. They don't know that world. I mean, if we take it over there and leave it over there, they probably die. I mean, they don't know what to do.
Today's Sunday. Like every Sunday, we start our Hispanic ministries at 5:30. Basically, the whole family, you know, up on stage playing music. My mom, she sings. My brother, he plays drums. My sister plays bass. My dad plays guitar, and I play saxophone. My dad's the pastor here, and in his sermons, he preaches a lot about keeping the faith even in tough times because, you know, we're never alone, even though it kind of seems like it.
Y verán al Hijo del Hombre viniendo sobre las nubes del cielo con poder.
He does like pastor part time. He does remodeling full time. We're in Goshen, Indiana. My dad recently just got a contract here, and this is our first job in maybe a month.
You want me to take the trim, like the bottom tiles, like the trim tile all around?
We're basically tearing a bathroom apart.
Samuel is a destroyer. He's the one tearing down the whole thing. He's good making a mess. He's a natural talent.
Things were going great, but now like things have slowed down. And that's kind of important to us because that's where my dad's revenue comes from. It's not to the degree where we don't have anything to eat, but it's just like there's a lot of stress in the house.
Take all the stuff out, and we need to bring the tub and begin to set it up.
I wish I was doing homework or something that doesn't involve dust and stuff, but it's okay.
Really, that is not something I want for him. For not even my kids. Work and the way I work. No, I don't want for them to get a laid tile or fix a carpet. I mean, they can be educated in this country.
My dad has said various times, you are going to college. I don't care how, we're getting you in there because you have to get an education, which I completely understand and I get it. Because if I don't, I'm just going to be a chump. Can't be a chump. Graduation, Sunday, May 31st, that was a really, really cool day. I put on my robe and looked in the mirror. I was like, whoa, we're here. Crap. I got there and I saw the rest of my peers, you know, just everybody was in blue. My counselor goes, hey, here. And she gives me my Indiana Honors Diploma medallion. And she's like, hey, congratulations, you earned it. And I gave her a hug and I took it out of the case and put it on my neck and I was like, ha ha ha.
My name is Gail Draper and I am the head of guidance here at Elkhart Central High School. I did not know for certain until this year that Sam was an undocumented student. That's not something that comes up in conversation, usually until the college application process.
The whole college process was really frustrating. When they say, are you a citizen of the U.S. or a citizen of Mexico? I'm like, I don't know. I almost feel like E.T., alien.
Because they were undocumented, they were uncertain. Do we tell people we're undocumented? Don't we tell people? Does he even have a chance to go?
I'd really hoped to go to Indiana University down in Bloomington, the biggest campus of all of them, and what they're really known for is music. But what happened was I applied a little too late, and then, you know, I had applied at another school, but they asked for my permanent residence card. I was just like, whoa, we have a problem. So right now, the only place that'll take me is IUSB. Or Indiana University of South Bend.
And it's not that IUSB is a bad school, but he needs to go to a school where there's more competition. There's not that many instrumentalists at IUSB.
The other thing is that when my dad and I talked to Mrs. Draper, we found out that we really don't qualify for financial aid or loans because of my status. So I have no idea how we're going to pay for tuition.
That's probably one of the hardest things I deal with in my job. We take students where they're at, we educate them, we inspire them to go to college, and then for our undocumented students, we say, we can't help you. You can't get a driver's license, so you can't get to school. You can't have money to go to school. You can't really get a job if you're following the letter of the law. It's like a ball dropping.
May each of you have the very best of good fortune in your futures. We are now declared the class of 2009 graduated.
Next thing I knew, I looked up and there were like hundreds of hats in the air. And I threw mine up and my first initial thought, I was like, I'm free. My second thought was, crap, I lost my hat. And so then I looked stupid looking for my hat. But when I threw that hat up, it was just like this feeling of, this is it. You jump. Now, I don't know if there are feathers or rocks at the bottom. I'm just hoping for the best. And, you know, it'll be great someday. Maybe not right now, but just keep hoping and praying and stuff and pray some more until the knees are raw.
I know that Sam is devastated by the thought of not being able to go to school. His dream is to go to college. His passion is to go for music and to be able to use that music to touch others. Will he have the chance? I don't know. An excerpt from American Dreamer, Sam's Story, produced by Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister for Long Haul Productions in association with Latino USA. American Dreamer won this year's Third Coast Radio Impact Award. After this story aired, Sam received enough listener donations to fund his first 2 years of college. He's a sophomore right now. But his future, at least as far as becoming a U.S. citizen, depends on a hotly debated piece of legislation in Congress called the DREAM Act. As you can imagine, Sam took this project on with a little trepidation due to his status. But as he told the audience at the Third Coast Awards ceremony, he's glad he did.
If through my story I can help one other person, so be it. And it's just sad that thousands of kids just like me, that are just kids, are running in the same shoes that I am. Hopefully, someday soon, this will change. Thank you to all the donors that have put me in college and have kept me there, and I will not disappoint you. Thank you.
To hear American Dreamer in its entirety, and to see a picture of Sam with his beloved saxophone, Bertha, visit thirdcoastfestival.org and hear Sam performing with Bertha. That brings us to the end of this hour of Best of the Best, the 2010 Third Coast Festival broadcast, featuring the winners of the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation competition. After 10 years of curating, collecting, and listening, we here at the Third Coast Festival have learned that all stories have something to teach us. We may recognize it immediately, or it may trickle into our consciousness more slowly. Great stories, well told, reflect our experience, capture our imagination, and make all our lives just a little bit better. Plus, they make great gifts. We hope you've enjoyed yours. Remember, extraordinary stories are everywhere. All we have to do is listen. Thanks for joining us. I'm Gwen Macsai. To hear this year's winning stories and to glimpse the winners accepting their awards, check out thirdcoastfestival.org, where you can also learn about the festival's year-round activities, including a weekly radio show and podcast, live listening events in Chicago and beyond, and much more. The executive director of the festival is Johanna Zorn. The artistic director is Julie Shapiro. Katie Mingle produces the Third Coast Festival's weekly radio show, ReSound. The Third Coast International Audio Festival is a nonprofit arts organization made possible with lead support from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Additional support is provided by the Boeing Company Charitable Trust, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Chicago's Navy Pier, and American Airlines. The Third Coast International Audio Festival was founded in 2000 by WBEZ Chicago. Best of the Best is produced by Emily Botine with help from Katie Mingle and Ben Shapiro for the Third Coast International Audio Festival and is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.
Join us Christmas Day at noon for Professor Paul Landis' reading of A Christmas Carol. For years, the live reading at the auditorium was a traditional part of the pre-holiday scene for students and faculty at the university. The tradition lives on at AM 580, where we broadcast this recording every year. Sit back and enjoy Professor Landis' reading of A Christmas Carol, Saturday at noon on AM 580. WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.